For 30 years, your voice, your morning. John McKenzie's Morning, only on 4CA 846.
Now, developments from this dreadful, dreadful business in Iraq and Syria. It said in The Australian on Saturday, Australians fighting with Islamic State now face almost certain death on the battlefield as the terrorist group loses the war in Iraq, and its myth of invincibility, according to the Prime Minister. Now, this is in his strongest comments yet about the retreat of Islamic State forces in Iraq. Malcolm Turnbull said the terror organisation was clearly on the defensive, losing territory and lives as its dream of a caliphate was progressively destroyed. I won't go on with all the details of it. There are a lot of concerns about those Australians, numbered at around 110 arriving back in Australia, and you might have heard a senior police officer in Victoria talking about the need to embrace the opportunity to have them assimilated back into the community, which of course raised a heck of a lot of hackles. The Prime Minister said it's critically important to demolish ISIL's myth of invincibility and inevitable victory. Far from sweeping across Europe to stable their horses in the Vatican, ISIL is now seen on the defensive, losing territory, resources and lives. To get an update on these developments, I've got Lieutenant General John Gray, former head of Australian Army, on the line. John, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, John.
These figures coming through now, these updates, obviously have got to be of a positive nature.
Yes, I think they are, John. I think what we're seeing now is a fairly significant reduction in the ISIL successes in Syria and Iraq. We're coming up to the key objectives of Mosul and al-Raqqa being taken on by the non-ISIL forces, and the Prime Minister also has come up and said we definitely need boots on the ground, but those boots should be Iraqis and Syrians, and they should be defeating ISIL. So it's pretty clear that from a national perspective, our support will continue to be the counter-terrorist or special forces people that we have there advising and helping to train, together with our strike aircraft that are participating. But what's important, I think, is that we're seeing a bit of a switch, I think, with ISIL, where they're covering their losses on the battlefield by trying to create terrorist incidents, particularly so far in France and Belgium. Mm. But they're undoubtedly also trying in the UK, and we've got to be particularly alert in Australia too. And there was a recent report over the weekend of the arrest of some people in Indonesia who were going, the claim was that they were going to try and fire a rocket to hit the Marina Bay area of Singapore. And Singapore has gone to a higher state of alert because of the terrorist threat also. So we can't be sure that that the terrorist threat won't arise in Australia, and obviously people here have to be very alert to anything that looks unusual or out of place and need to inform the police if they see something like that.
Now, when you hear terms like the caliphate nearing extinction, obviously there are some observers saying the end is nigh for ISIL, ISIS, whatever you want to call it. I'd love you to give us an estimate with your background, with your expertise in this area, as to when that might happen, if indeed there would be a significant number of these terrorists who would be prepared to surrender, if any.
John, I think it's... let me answer the last question first, and that is, would they be a number of them be prepared to surrender? Very hard to estimate that. Those who are heavily radicalised will undoubtedly not surrender. There are some who are probably on the fringes, and what we're seeing with the a number of jihadi participants who are now saying, we went over through Turkey and went into Syria and Iraq, but of course we were there on humanitarian means. We're all going to be medics to look after people and help refugees. So we want to come home now because death is staring us in the eye. Mm-hmm. So I think what we'll see are two. The extremists will not surrender. Some of them will, and they're the less radicalised ones, if you like. Now, how long will this last for? That's a very difficult question to answer when the sources I use are basically public information and I haven't got eyes on the ground there telling me what is the intent of these people. Mm. But my view is that given the there are two things that are a factor here. One is the fact that more people are trying to escape from ISIL's control, and we're seeing that with some of the people trying to come back to Australia. Mm. The second thing is that ISIL's funding has been significantly dropping. They were able to capture oil wells. They were able to receive income to fund their war. There was one estimate in March of this year by IHS James who said that their income of $80 million a month had dropped to $56 million a month, and it's still dropping. So from that perspective, I think they're running out of funds to fund their war as well. So my view would be that the main part of this thrust in terms of a caliphate may be defeated in the next 12 to 18 months, but that's a very, I suppose it's an educated guess at best.
All right, let's just focus on the emerging threats, as the term used here is the caliphate nears extinction. The focus, it points out in this article today in The Australian, will be on Western Europe, as you pointed out earlier on. Are we talking about just one-off attacks by single terrorists, even amateurs, that are somehow or other inspired by the message of the terrorists, or are we talking about much more organised and massive attacks in Western Europe as the caliphate, as they say here, becomes extinct?
Yeah, John, I think we'll see a combination of both. Again, I think that you'll find that there's the odd individual who will decide that they've become radicalised. They believe that it's their role to do something. They're totally disaffected with their own society or with the society in which they're living, and then they will carry out the attacks, such as, for example, the attack in Belgium on two police women with a machete, and that fellow was killed, but both the police women were seriously injured. Mm-hmm. You can't, and the same with a truck driver in Nice. So those sort of events will still happen. But the thing we've got to be really wary about is the latent groups, those groups that have been radicalised and are working as a group. And that requires very good intelligence and police intelligence to actually counter them. Now, I think that what we've seen so far is... we've seen a number of these groups caught first. And, for example, the one in Indonesia with the likely attack on Marina Bay in Singapore through a rocket. They didn't find a rocket yet, incidentally, but they have got a number of people who are involved in that group. So I think those sorts of groups will continue. And what I think we'll see is a spreading of those sleeper groups, if you like, in societies around the world. Now, there was also a report saying that... Australia was going to be third on the list of ISIL for terrorist attacks and that we couldn't relax. Well, I don't think we've ever thought we could relax, but the fact that our name comes up in headlines there means that we do have to really, really focus on this.
Yes.
The other part, and it's interesting because there's a man who's just been arrested, Philip Gallagher in Melbourne, and he's been charged with two terrorist offences, but he's not Islamic. He's not an Islamic extremist. And he's been charged with collecting or making documents likely to facilitate a terrorist attack as the first charge. The second charge is acts done in preparation for or planning a terrorist act. So what we've got to be careful of, and the laws are there to protect society, is that we've got other people who are likely to become extremists but not Islamic who can also decide that perhaps this is the way of life for them.
Now, can I
the problem we've got is what do you do with these people when you after you arrest them? Let's assume that they've been found guilty by a court. They're put in jail. What do you then do? How do you de-radicalise them? Or if you put them into your jail... into any of your jails around the country, how do you ensure that they're not radicalising other people that they're in jail with?
Of course.
And this is a real issue.
Mm. In fact, there's been numerous question marks about the effectiveness of de-radicalisation. Do you have faith in the sort of means that are being used at the moment, particularly in de-radicalising young Muslims?
I don't think anyone knows how to do it yet. I've been looking at some of the literature on this, and there's a fair amount of study going on. The conclusions that most academics looking at this at the moment see is that there's no single formula that you can deal with it through using that formula. You're looking to try to find out what is their motivation and how do you address de-radicalising them from that motivation. Mm. And that means that you have to have prison programs, you've got to have education, you need to be promoting the alliance of your civilizations and your intercultural dialogues. You need to be tackling economic and social inequities as well. And, of course, all of this is either facilitated or hindered by use of the internet. So within your jail system, for those that you put into jail, do you cut them off from the internet or do you, in my view, I think you have to censor the internet so that those who have been radicalised can't get access to internet locations which increase their radicalisation. Mm. And then you've got to develop a system to either say, all right, these people are showing all the signs now of being stable and you can put them back into society. Mm. Well, what do you do with those that you can't say that about? And I notice the Prime Minister of Australia has been saying perhaps there's a case for permanent prison systems for people who have been radicalised, yeah, who you can't de-radicalise,
yes,
and put back into your society. Mm. Now, if you do that, do you need a special prison for all those who are radicalised, put them all in one place and have a happy little radicalisation programs? Or do you leave them spread amongst your prison systems, which are all, of course, state-run?
And contaminate them all.
And what do you do with it? Mm. So there's some very big issues here, and no one knows the answer. There's a program for de-radicalisation going on in Singapore, which I know James Cook University has been having a look at to see what can be learnt from that. But this is a big issue, and it's an issue where if we've got, for example, using the figures you quoted this morning, of 110 jihadis who are likely to want to come back to Australia at one point in time, how do you treat these people, and how do you know what they've done while they were over in Syria or Iraq?
Yes.
Is your intelligence good enough to tell you that? And then how do you handle that?
Precisely.
And there's a cost to all this, of course.
Great to talk to you, John. Thank you.
Okay, John.
Former head of the Australian Army, Lieutenant General John Gray, and former Chancellor over at the University, James Cook University.